welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 544, and I know it's been a while, so if you don't recognize me, I'm one of your hosts, Skyler Vicroy, and joining me, it seems like almost I could say as usual these days, is none other than our good friend Jim. How's it going, buddy?
It's going pretty good, Skyler. Freezing with snow on the ground, but doing good. Sooner or later, spring will come, motors will run, and I'll be a happy camper.
Oh, there you go. That was a nice little, almost like a haiku. So it's been, I think, Jim, you had said it's been a month, I think, since you did a recording.
And, yes.
I knew we were going to take some time off, but holy crap, that went by, a month went by. I was expecting maybe a week or two. Then next thing you know, I'm like, dude, we got to get a show out. So it's glad to be back. I had a good holiday. Probably ate too much food, as the scale will tell you. But other than that, things are going good over here on my end. How about you, Jim?
Things aren't too bad here. Got my tickets to go to COTA and watch the races there. So that's looking good. Got some other cool stuff that came from Mr. Claus himself. Some nice tools and whatnot. But we're just trying to hunker in the bunker and not suffer cabin fever with the terrible weather we've been having here in the Midwest.
Absolutely. You know, I don't really have to deal with the weather where I live. It's like I said, it's going to be 66 and sunny tomorrow. So I might even just leave the jacket in the truck when I pull up to work.
You're killing me.
But well, it's good to hear. Glad everything's going good on your end. Like you were saying, though, there's some new stuff coming around. Oh, and I purchased my flights out to Austin as well. So everybody, I know there's going to be, it looks like we're going to have almost half the hosts, if not more, out there, which should be interesting.
Yep. Should be really fun.
So for the show this year, we're going to do things slightly different. But we're going to add in some new sections. We're going to, you know, try to keep it weekly going forward. You know, still maybe a little hit and miss when we don't have a lot of content to talk about. But as soon as the tests start going, and that'll get us going as well, and we'll get down to the nitty-gritty. But Jim has a new segment he's been working on. I'll let you tell them what you've been doing there, Jim.
Well, I came up with an idea that based on a lot of the emails and stuff that come in, some of you seem to be out there thirsting for a little more in-depth kind of technical analysis of what's going on in the world of MotoGP. So I sat around over the holiday break and I came up with this idea of doing a little thing called Jim's Corner. And in that, I kind of explain something about MotoGP or bike racing, whether it's tires, rider technique, could be anything. The first one I did was on the mass damper system that Ducati has in the tail section of their motorcycle. If it makes the show into this show, I think it will. Hopefully you guys will enjoy it. It's about 18 minutes of me just sort of rambling on, being very geeky about things all related to motorcycles and engineering and whatnot. So hopefully you'll find it interesting. Hopefully you guys, if you have any ideas, you can always reach out to me on Twitter, and you could also contact us via email with an idea that maybe you want to know a little bit more of something about. And, you know, it's not going to be something that's regular. It's just going to be when we have a more in-depth kind of subject that people want to know about, kind of do some research on it and try to put it together and explain it for you and make it make sense.
Yeah, that's cool. I think, you know, a lot of times we don't get to answer some of the emails on the show because we get to them, you know, pretty heavily in going back and forth with all the hosts in a chain. But a lot of times it's, I think a lot of the listeners miss out on the good information that's going back and forth, and people ask some really good questions that get sent into us. So, as you know, something like that, I think is a great addition to the show, and I'm excited to see what kind of stuff you come up with.
So far I got a few in my pocket, but we'll see how the first one goes and then we'll kind of go from there.
Excellent. So other things to look forward to this year. Obviously Jim's going to be jumping up and taking a bigger role. This, you'll probably hear him lead hosting majority of the shows. This is kind of like my last month before my hurricane of work and school and all that stuff hits here at the end of the month. So as soon as that gets fully going, about a month in or so, I probably become a ghost around here for a little while and reemerge sometime in the summer. So, and then I have a wedding right off the bat in the summer, so that I might still be kind of disappearing until after that gets completed. But,
well, you know, it wasn't bad enough that you decided you're going to go back to school and do an internet radio show. You decided you had to get married too.
Yeah. Oof. Yeah. No. And we're you know, less than 6 months out now, and it feels every day like it too, because all the stuff that we have, a lot of stuff taken care of, but I'm sure any of you out there that are either planning to get married or going through the process or are married can definitely know what I'm talking about. It's all these little things you never knew you had to take care of.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I remember those days. I remember that. I did it simply. I said, "Hey, sweetheart, tell me the address of the church. Tell me what time I'm supposed to show up, and I'll be there."
Yeah. No, I that tried doesn't
to. Work nowadays.
No, I tried to tell. I was like, "Oh, you know, I don't want to really do much. I did my part, right? And that doesn't work that way. You got to, you know, sign off on some stuff and ideas, and you got to try to help a little bit." But it's coming together good. We got some cool stuff we're doing. So I'll be excited to kind of cross that finish line, though. It's there's been a long process, but I'm excited to get there and get on to the next things in life. But yeah, no. So with this show, we're doing something a little different. This is not going to be a normal show, obviously. Since we started, we're not really going to go into the news. This is a show we're actually combining with our good friend Martin and his partner Andrew that work on History by Hollywood. They did a show on the world's fastest Indian, which is a fun little movie, but they're actually going to be taking over here once me and Jim kind of get done with what we need to talk about and sign off. But they're definitely going to be stick around. It's if you haven't listened to any of their shows, they do a lot of work. I mean, I really don't know where they find the time to do all the reading and research that they do to pump out these shows every 2 weeks. Honestly, it makes me look terrible that I can't even get together a MotoGP show where all the information is done for me. I just got to read what's on a website.
Yeah, I've listened to a few of the History by Hollywoods, just some of the ones that interested me, because Martin was doing it and I was, always been a fan of Martin, what he thought. And I really enjoyed his Apollo 13 one. I really enjoyed, what was the other one that they did? At the top of my head, I can't remember what it was. But there's been two or three of them that I've found enjoyable. I mean, things that I didn't know. It's insightful. It's definitely a different spin. And I think as bike guys, I think all of us really enjoy this one. I have to lay claim that I've never watched the movie yet. I probably should before I listen to the show, but I'm running out of time on that one. But hey, life gets in the way sometimes. But I think it'll all be good. I think it'll be a good little stopover before we get into testing and before we get back to talking about bikes all the time. And I think it's just nice to have a different perspective, especially, Andrew. I don't think Andrew's that big of a bike guy from what I take, but he's a movie buff and he's a history buff, and it comes across really, really well. So stick around, listen to it. I think it's going to be great.
Yeah, no, they say they do great work, and I'm looking forward to listening to the episode when it comes out, because the amount of information that they pull out is surprising. There was, like you were saying, you listened to a couple. One of the ones I was really surprised with, especially on my driving job, I had plenty of time to listen because they can be long shows, but they did one on Pocahontas. And I was thinking to myself, like, how much interest do I have in this? And the way they went on and explained everything, and they went down the lineage of her, where they live and where they came from, and where her descendants are now, and all this stuff. It's like, man, where do you even find half this information? But anyway, so stick around. We'll be getting to that soon. As far as the motorcycle racing front, it is, pretty much winter. Everybody's been training. There was the Super Prestigio, which I didn't quite get a chance to catch, but if I'm not mistaken, did JD win it this year?
I think JD did. I didn't get a chance to watch it either, but I think he ran off and hit on everybody. Because it wasn't that bad. A lot of the big names weren't there riding, and so that hurts a little bit. But hey, everybody needs some time away, especially after a long season like they had. So, but it was, I think it's one of those events that it depends on what Mark Marquez does.
Yeah,
pretty much. Really, I think he's obviously the king of Spain when it comes to motorcycles. And if he's there, I think it's great attendance and everybody kind of pays more attention to it. And if Mark isn't there, it kind of becomes not a second run show, but I think it becomes less important.
Yeah, some of the polish is off of it, right? So it looks good, but it's not as shiny. So,
yep.
If you're really itching to get some motorcycle action, of course, there's always Supercross this time of year, and I love Supercross. I mean, that's just It's a nice compact, you know, you get those two races. Well, you know, if you don't watch everything, because it can be a 4-hour ordeal, but I just watch the mains. I don't really watch the heats, but this year should be interesting. I don't know if you saw round one from Anaheim, but
I did. I followed it.
Roczen made his comeback, and they did a little segment on how gnarly his arm got messed up, and the fact that guy is on a motorcycle and got the result that he did. I don't want to spoil it in case you haven't seen it. Man, that guy is impressive. That was some work he did this offseason.
Yeah, I wanted to put a shout out to Ken Roczen. I mean, I realize we're kind of like a road race show, but here's a guy who last year, third race of the season, he's trying to clear like a rhythm section and he gets it just wrong or cross ruts and he crashes on his right arm and he breaks it severely.
He basically exploded his arm.
Pretty much. He basically destroyed basically his wrist. He had to have the end of the bone that connects to your wrist and makes your hand motion, the top of, I think the radius bone, they said, he had to get it from a cadaver and have it grafted onto his because his was in so many pieces, they couldn't even put it back together again. And then he had complications from what they call compartmental syndrome, where the swelling was so bad in his arm that basically blood flow basically would not go through it to nourish the muscles and everything that's in your arm there. And he came within a whisker of having his arm amputated and not even having an arm. And so 350 days after that accident, he's back on a motorcycle racing Supercross, which to me, sir, a tip of the Motopod hat to you because that was absolutely impressive.
Yeah, that's you know, practice, heats, and a main on that arm that still he's got, what, 70% of mobility, I think, in that thing or something like that?
Something like that. It's 70 or 80%. He doesn't quite have it all, and he has a specially made brace there to support it so that hopefully it won't be hurt again. But, yeah, I mean, we talk about our guys, how they ride through pain and what they do and how road racers see things on a different level. And in Rossi, he breaks his leg, comes back, what was it, 20 days, and he's racing, you know. And I admit, Rossi's leg break was bad. It was plated, but it was not to the level of injury that Ken Roczen had. And for Roczen to even be back racing on a motorcycle is – it's otherworldly. It really is. It's an amazing story. If you haven't checked into Supercross or know Ken Roczen's story, I'm sure it's out there on YouTube or something somewhere. Check it out. It's really impressive.
Yep. So, you know, Jim, I, you know, wanted to keep it short and sweet because I didn't want to, you know, have a 2-hour show. And I definitely want people to get on over to Martin's podcast. So, once again, that's going to be the world's fastest Indian. Little bit of the synopsis. It stars Anthony Hopkins, who's in the lead role. It's covering the eccentric Kiwi Burt Munro's speed record attempts at the Bonneville Salt Flats on a 1920s Indian Scout motorcycle. So make sure you get over and check that out. Is there anything else you wanted to bring up, Jim, before we sign out of here?
If you really need some racing action, check out that car. Rally in South America. The motorcycle class is absolutely incredible this year. It's been a different winner on different stages. I think on almost every stage has been a different winner. And I know this much, the leader is only leading by 1 minute. And in rally terms, that's like being side by side at the finish line. It has been pretty brutal, has been incredible. Check it out. I think Lynn had a tweet out there to follow. I can't think of the guy's name, but he is one of the heroes of that car. He's kind of doing it as a privateer effort. Follow him on Twitter. Find Lynn's tweet. Follow him on Twitter and check out the Dakar if you need to. Otherwise, sit back, relax, and wait for Martin to show up with his docile tones and learn about an Indian going really fast in the salt flats.
So, all right. Well, that's it for me. Thank you for coming back in. I know we're off a little bit, but it's back to the regularly scheduled program now. And enjoy History by Hollywood. See you, Jim.
See you.
Hello, and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is this is 500 and something. Skyler or Andrew or Jim will have told you, no doubt. And this is our first crossover show between my two podcasting entities. So we've got a History by Hollywood episode that, because it's about motorcycles going fast, we're going to put out as a Motopod show. And also, happy New Year, everybody.
Yeah, indeed. Happy New Year.
Yeah, just a quick explanation. If the sound sounds very different, it's because Andrew is still in Qatar. I was meant to be back there, but due to a, not a family crisis, but a family member having an operation, I've delayed my return from the UK. So we're doing this over Skype. So if the sound quality is not up to the usual standards, we do apologise, but hopefully it will be listenable. Also, if any of you do like what you hear on either History by Hollywood or Motopod, please do leave us a review on whichever platform you use to listen, because it really helps to spread the word. So thank you, and now on with the show.
As always, let's start with the story of the movie, The World's Fastest Indian. The World's Fastest Indian is a 2005 independent New Zealand movie, as we say, stars Welsh actor Anthony Hopkins, playing the lead role of New Zealand motorbike racer Burt Munro. It was directed and written and produced by New Zealand director Roger Donaldson, who had already made a couple of Hollywood films with some big-name stars, but real success and major awards have evaded him so far. This is perhaps his most charming and successful movie to date. It's set in the 1960s and tells the journey and results of Munro's trip to Speed Week on the salt flats of Bonneville, Utah, USA. The movie is really Donaldson's pet project. He'd been working on it one way or another for 20 years, and he'd already made a short documentary about Munro in the 1970s. It's a critical success with an 82% positive score on Rotten Tomatoes, and took about $5 million in New Zealand and another $18 million worldwide, after costing about $25 million to make. So it broke even, or maybe not even broke even, so may even be a financial loss. It runs for just over 2 hours and was filmed in Munro's hometown of Invercargill, New Zealand. Many of the mechanical props and machinery shown in the movie were actually Munro's own pieces borrowed from the local museum. The racing scenes, the speed scenes, were shot on-site in Utah, USA.
Yeah, and I think it's there's been quite a few sort of niche documentaries made about Burt Munro, who, when he was going to Bonneville and attempting and beating some of these speed records, he was in his 60s. So for people of the age of Andrew and I, it's a wonderful way of showing that, hey, we ain't done yet.
Yeah, it's an inspirational movie in that respect.
Absolutely. Our sources for the information on the reality of this is a number of documentaries, including Roger Donaldson's Offerings to the God of Speed. And I read a book by a New Zealand journalist called Neil Burse. And the book is basically a series of interviews with Burt Munro, with him reminiscing. Predictably, when he was in his 60s, having been born in 1899, he's passed on now, Burt Munro. He died in the late 70s. He did have some heart trouble, as shown in the movie. But Neil Burse's book is fascinating, and you can hear the voice of a somewhat single-minded eccentric.
Yeah, and remarkably, I've found a book on New Zealand sporting heroes about their underdog status, and the book's called Long Shots, The Greatest Underdog Stories in New Zealand Sport, which features a chapter on Munro, and remarkably, I borrowed that book from the Qatar National Library.
Oh, that's pretty good.
All right, so let's start the show and get on with the movie. The World's Fastest Indian opens with scenes of a workshop. The camera pans across all sorts of bits and pieces, including one of the shelves has got a sign with the words "Offering to the God of Speed" written on it. We saw various engine parts, and we hear a voice counting out loud, and we get to see Burt Munro, played by Anthony Hopkins, for the first time. He's then pacing a beach with a measuring wheel before he then runs along the beach racing his motorcycle. The bike is shown to be clearly built for straight line speed, low, long, with dropped handlebars and rear pegs set near the rear wheel hub. Burt's revving it, waking up neighbours who are not impressed. Then we see the neighbour's young son come into Burt's workshop as Burt is melting some Chevy parts to make a piston from scratch, saying that he's concocted the perfect recipe for a piston.
Yeah, Burt talks about his speed runs to the young lad who's called Tom. He's played by young actor Aaron Murphy. And he says how many times he's run his bike on the beach and a few times on the road, say he was a bit over the speed limit. The young lad says, how fast are you going? And Bert says, I have no idea. That's why I need to go to Bonneville, which is the salt flats in the US, where most of the world's speed records are set. Bert borrows Tom's parents' kitchen knife to use on his newly made piston, but Tom's mother, showing barely concealed exasperation, comes to get it back and her sharpener. So you can see that Bert Munro only cares about his engineering works. In the next scene, we see Bert collecting his pension, which tells us that his age is somewhere in the 60s. And the clerk, the pension clerk, is called Fran, played by Annie Whittle. And he asks her if she'll accompany him to a function the following night. And she says, Bert Munro, are you asking me out on a date? And he sort of laughs and says, I suppose I am. So you get the idea, he's a little bit awkward around women and other humans, probably. And then back at his workshop, Bert's trimming his toenails with a grinder fitted in an electric drill. Young Tom arrives and he sees what he's doing and cries out, it's disgusting, which makes Bert laugh. So we get the idea, he is an eccentric man.
Yeah. Shall we compare any of that to reality?
Yeah, I mean, Roger Donaldson's documentary, The Offerings to the God of Speed, he got the title from the shelf on which Bert had written it in reality, and he kept, basically they were all blown pistons. He rarely threw things away, although he often recycled them. So that bit's spot on, and the bit about, you know, building this bike in the workshed, he bought the Indian Scout in the 20s, and I mean, the engineering bits, he was an incredible guy. He made all sorts of stuff in this little back garden shed workshop.
I mean, apparently, you know, that they portray that very accurately. They show a bed in the corner of the workshop, and that he really did have a bed and slept in there. So, you know, he lived his life with his machinery. They show the young lad getting water from a barrel for the tea kettle, and later on we see the same water being used, or maybe I forget the sequence, but the same water is used for the hot piston that he's poured molten metal into, and the young lad comments how that's the same water we've been drinking our tea out of. Well, apparently that's true too. He was reusing the same water for various reasons, including cups of tea. And so they're setting the scene pretty well for him, I think. And the fact that he asks the pension clerk out for a date as well, he did like the ladies as well. He's a couple of quotes, well, life's a lot better when there's a woman involved, well, in real life.
Yeah, he was definitely a bit of a lad. I mean, his engineering background, he made all sorts of things. As a child, he blew up a shed, and his father thought, you know, that's it, the Germans have arrived, because this was during the First World War. And Bert was experimenting. I think he was trying to make some kind of generator work faster or better. During the First World War, with petrol rationing, he had a motorbike in his teens, and he actually made, sorry, this was, no, Second World War. This would have been, he made a gas converter for his motorcycle, or motorcycle, as he refers to it. And so he didn't use much petrol because it was petrol rationing. The problem with the gas converter, there was no throttle effect, so it was either maximum or off, which led to some incidents. But he'd ridden bikes all his life. In the First World War, as a 15-year-old, he made a gun, a cannon, and it worked. And although it was confiscated when people realised what he'd made, local sort of home guards or the militia used it to practice gun laying for their artillery training. It's incredible.
And I don't think he had any formal training, did he? His engineering skills are great, but he was a motorcycle repairman and a motorcycle salesman, I think, by profession.
Yeah, and he'd worked as a lumberjack, he'd worked on road crews, and whenever he got given a job, clearly, when you read the interviews, and some of the stuff written about him, he'd immediately start looking for ways to improve systems, you know. And then, yeah, he was a motorcycle salesman, and he used to ride all over New Zealand to deliver these bikes. So just an absolute bike nut, really, really impressive, if you like bikes.
Yeah. Well, I think they set the scene well then for the main character in the opening scenes. Shall we turn back to the movie action?
Absolutely.
Okay. Next scene, we see Bert and his date, Fran, arriving at the dance where everyone seems to know who Bert is. And we discover that it's his birthday and the party is being run to raise money so that Bert can go to the USA. There's a raffle and the prize is being a live pig and some beer. We see Bert get up to the stage to make his speech to thank everybody for coming, and a biker gang crash the scene and demand to race against the old coot. Bert is unfazed and throws down a challenge. Suddenly, it's the next day, and we're on the beach where bets are made as the gang prepares to all race against Bert. The bikers race off, but Bert needs a push to get going, and when he does, he zooms past all the other bikes, clearly going much, much, much faster than anyone around him. However, at the turn mark to come back to the crowd, marked by a barrel, Bert falls off and has to watch the bike gang leave him standing as he tries to race the bike on his own. So Bert's beaten, and he's back in the car with Fran, and she asks him how much it'll cost for him to go to the US. Bert says around $2,000 and says that he's still around $700 short. Fran offers to lend him the money, but he declines. Next, we see Bert and Fran ordering dinner at a food stand, open-air food stand, pies, peas and pud, and she suggests that he mortgages his house.
Yeah, back at Bert's house the following morning, we see him wake up with Fran, and we get the idea he likes the ladies. And he's making some tea when he suddenly clutches his chest, and the next thing we see is he's being taken to hospital. A doctor tells him he's had an attack of angina caused by a narrowing of the arteries. And after a bit of discussion, he says, will it affect my motorcycling? And she says, oh, I think your motorcycling days are over. And his answer to that is, like hell they are. And the next thing we see is he's with his bank manager, and he's telling about the trip he needs to make to the Bonneville Salt Flats. And the manager's asked what collateral he's offering for a loan, and Bert realises when he says, well, you know, there's bits and pieces in my workshop, and you can have those, and the manager says, well, I think we need a bit more than that, and Bert realises he has to put his house up for surety that he'll pay back the loan. And you get the idea, he's very, very, incredibly good at engineering. He's not so he's a little bit naive in real world matters.
In the real world, yeah. Yeah, and what about his personal life? He's got the love interest in, I think, the fictional Fran.
Quick reality check on that bit, yeah? So, yeah, the biker gang thing is a device created by the movie. There's no mention that he was ever threatened or there were animosity, but he would say that he was forever being challenged to races by, you know, these young'uns who fancy themselves, old man with an old bike, what chance has he got? And then they see that, I mean, this is Bert Munro's own words, so I'm sure sometimes he was beaten, but he certainly took part in a lot of beach races and road races. And some of these would have happened in the days before speed limits. So the raising the money, he was never wealthy. He was always scraping and saving and selling things. And he had other bikes as well. He had a Bella set that he used to race in New Zealand. He'd been to Australia. But yeah, he certainly struggled, I think, to raise the money for all these trips he made. But he always seemed to manage it.
Yeah, and they suggest that he's this eccentric bachelor in the movie, and there's no mention of a family life, and they took a bit of liberty there, didn't they? He actually had at least one wife, who was his ex-wife by this time, and he had four children, is that right, Martin?
Yeah, a wife and four kids, and his wife left him, and you can sort of understand why. He wasn't a bad person, it's just his focus wasn't on his family. Now, we've got a little clip here which might illustrate why he would have been a frustrating husband for a mother who cared more about her kids than anything else.
The family were quite small. I would say I would be about perhaps 9 or 10 at the time. And father decides that if a car can pull a trailer, a motorbike can pull a trailer. So he sets to and makes one. Four children in our family, three girls and a boy, and we used to go to Riverton Rocks for holidays, a small seaside resort near Invercargill. And put the children in the trailer and away we set out to Riverton Rocks. At that time the roads were mostly gravel, and we got going in this trailer anyway, and the faster we went the more it wobbled, and eventually all the children were spilled into the gravel. We were very sad and very upset about this. However, we were bundled back into the trailer and away we went again, and set off very slowly. While we went slowly, it was all right. And, of course, the faster we went, away it went again, started wobbling, and we were spilled out again, and all the children crying, and we bundled back into the trailer again, and however, we got to Riverton eventually.
So, as you can hear from Bert's daughter's testimony there, life with Bert as a dad would have been exciting and interesting, but a little bit on the dangerous side. Just as well to wrap up this reality check, the angina and the heart condition, it is something that plagued Bert throughout his later life.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's go back to the movie then. In the next scene in the movie, we see Tom with Bert in Bert's backyard, and he hears that Tom says he hears that Bert's got the money for the trip. Tom then asks if Bert's worried at all that he'll be killed if he crashes, to which Bert replies, "No. You live more in 5 minutes going flat out on a motorcycle than most people live in a lifetime." Bert then tells Tom about his twin brother, and he says that when they were both kids, his brother was killed by a falling tree. Bert says that since then he's never tried to be scared of anything, although he admits to getting a bit nervous before a big bike event. And Bert tells Tom that the hospital trip that he's just had was just over a bit of indigestion, playing it all down for the young lad. Asked by young Tom to mow his lawn, Tom reveals that his dad goes on and on about Bert's place lowering the property prices in the area. We see Bert pouring some petrol all over his lawn and launching a flaming brand into it. Laughing, Bert calls out that he's clearing the lawn before he goes away. The bike is next seen being loaded in some crates for shipping. Tom says goodbye and says his dad doesn't think Bert can break the record. Tom says everyone thinks that except him. Saying goodbye to the neighbours, Bert tells Tom, "If you don't go when you want to go, when you do go, you'll find you're gone."
I think that's a fantastic little quote, isn't it?
It is.
He's got these little nuggets, and it's a lovely relationship between almost like this grandfather figure who's still going out and doing things that you can imagine it, you know, an 11 or 12-year-old boy would have found exciting and fascinating and all of
and
that.
And actually, when you watch the documentary, the 1971 documentary, many of the lines that he uses, the nice little lines like that one, are real quotes from Bert Munro. So they made their way into the movie, which is nice.
There was a motorcycle racer that the Motorpod listeners would be very familiar with, the tragedy that hit Marco Simoncelli in Malaysia in 2011. He was killed during a race. But one of the quotes from Marco Simoncelli was, "I've lived more on..." You know, asked if it isn't worrying that it was dangerous, said, "I've lived more riding a bike in 5 minutes than most people live in a lifetime." So, but that was a Bert Munro quote from years before Marco Simoncelli said it himself. So it's probably a common theme, but it's definitely something that goes around. He's got some great, great little lines during the whole. He's just unfazed by anything, isn't he?
That's true. But what about the twin brother's death? They stretched the truth up just a little bit there, didn't they?
No, he did have a brother that was killed.
But it wasn't his twin brother, it was an older brother. So
right, yeah, it was his older brother, wasn't it?
I'm not sure why they didn't just stick to that, but anyway, minor departure from the truth.
So, back to the movie, we see Bert with Fran in his car, and he's a bit disappointed that more of the bike club haven't come to see him, and Fran says, "Well, most of them probably got work." And he says, do you think I can do this? And she says, "I don't think it really matters." So you sort of get the feeling that Fran's more interested in Bert the human than Bert the record breaker. But at the same time, it's like, if you don't think it matters, you don't get Bert, because it clearly matters to him. But just as they're preparing to drive away from the petrol station where they've been topping up the car, the bike gang from the beach race pull up. And the leader, who called him an old coot, hands Bert some beer money and wishes him luck. So there's a nice little pat on the back. He then leaves Fran at the dockyard, and she's going to use his car whilst he's away. So they say goodbye with a kiss. And then Bert meets the captain on board this ship, and he says, I'm meant to do a job to work this work my passage. And the captain says, I hope you can cook. And Bert looks a bit shocked and says, I'll give it a go. And then we see the ship plowing through heavy seas, and Bert and the crew are sitting out to movie. He gives them all a lecture about how they shouldn't smoke. And he was very anti-smoking throughout his life, but all credit to him. But when we get to the docks in America, he's clearly made friends along the way. And this is a theme throughout the movie. Every time Bert meets people, they just fall in love with him. They're like, people go an extra mile to help him. He's just a charming, charming old man. And he's wished well by the crew, and he goes to customs. But then he's taken into an office for an interview, because a senior customs official tells him that he gave some rather strange answers to their questions. Bert calmly says they're far away, and asked what his purpose was in visiting. He said, I'm going to try and break a land speed record at Bonneville on my 1920s Indian Scout motorcycle. But another customs official, fortunately, remembers reading about Bert in Mechanics Weekly, and they clear him, give him 6 months. But that whole customs process, you sort of get the idea, he's like too honest for his own good sometimes. You know, he's talking to the bank manager, and he mentions his chest pains, and the bank manager says, I'll pretend I didn't hear that. Yeah. So he says it again louder, and the man says, no, I heard it. I'm going to pretend I didn't hear it.
Well, do we want to do a quick reality check on some of that? We see him getting on a ship and crossing the ocean and working his passage. Now, that's something that he did quite regularly, because he made several trips across the ocean, and each time he worked to cover his passage. I'm not sure if he was a cook at all, but they got that right, didn't they?
Yeah, absolutely. He was doing everything on a shoestring. You know, he packed the bike up. The fairing you see on the bike as it's being packed up and ready to go is like a streamliner fairing, which he made himself. You know, he pretty much did everything himself. And it's probably worth pointing out at this stage that the movie has conflated lots of trips with lots of incidents that happened on various trips to the States, because he did go there 10 or 11 times, and they basically put it into one trip.
Yeah. You know, they do mention at the end that he did have multiple trips, but you're right. I mean, the way they're portraying it is, you know, the first half dozen trips are all kind of compressed into this initial voyage and trip to Bonneville. But the bit about, what about the bit about being getting out of trouble because he's recognized by a mechanical enthusiast, because he was, I think, on the cover of an edition of Mechanical Weekly? That actually happened, didn't it? He was in somewhere, he's getting around somewhere and got into trouble and got out of trouble because somebody recognized him as the guy that was on the cover of Mechanical Weekly. I think
that's right, but it wasn't the customs.
No.
One of his early trips, he diverted. What he'd do, he'd land in America, he'd buy a cheap car, use his mechanical nous to keep it going, because often they were old, clapped out things that he bought for $100. He quite often sold them for a profit. Having done a few thousand miles in them to Bonneville and back. But on one of his routes, he realized he was near, I think it was Edwards Air Force Base, where Chuck Yeager broke the sound barrier and all these sorts of things happened. And he diverted and was actually arrested taking photographs, because he said, I didn't notice the sign saying, yeah, you can't photograph. Sorry, I'll be off then. And this military policeman was like, no, you're under arrest. You know, you're a foreigner, you're taking photographs at a, you know, sensitive airbase. And it was in that incident where he's brought into one of these base officials. And this guy had read about Bert, and that's where that story comes from. And he ended up being shown the X-15, which was NASA's experimental aircraft. It was incredible. And he walked his way.
And the film, as you say, is full of people, him charming complete strangers to go an extra mile for him. But it's strange that they actually didn't use that story in the movie, because that's a real evidence that he's charming his way across America.
Yeah, I mean, it's a device the movie has used to show you how he was within the, you know, the really focused motorcycle world. He was quite a well-known name. So back to the movie. Bert gets in a yellow cab and asked to go to Hollywood to see where the movie stars live. And again, you see this sort of country boy from New Zealand naivety as he sees all these illuminated advertising boards, and he says, "Cool, they must have a heck of an electricity bill." At a motel, the taxi driver says, "The bill's 29, and I expect a 10% tip." Bert's horrified at the cost. Then he gets out of the cab, and a young girl gives him a flower and says he should give some money to needy people. And he gets his wallet out, and she says, "Oh, that'll do," and grabs a $10 bill. Then there's a prostitute who tells him she'll take him around the world for $15, and he laughingly says, "Well, I've already come from halfway around the world, leave me alone." Then he gets a room in this motel, which has a vibrating bed, which seems to baffle him. So you can see he's kind of a fish out of water.
Yeah, and we don't know whether any of those events really happened, but they do set the scene for him, as you say, being a fish out of water. Then we cut to the reception desk of the motel, which he's trying to settle into, and he finds out that his bike is ready for collection from the ship. The receptionist, Tina, played by Chris Williams, and clearly a transvestite, takes him to a restaurant for breakfast. Bert laughs and says, "I've never seen a menu with photographs," before ordering his food. He's asked how he likes his eggs. He replies, "Cooked." Bert asks Tina where the best place is to get a cheap car. She says, "The Valley," and offers to take him once they've done with breakfast. And she confesses to him, reveals that she's not really a girl. Bert says he thought there was something funny about her, but she's still a sweetheart, to which she smiles. So he's won her over, or won the transvestite over for sure. Then we see Bert meet a salesman, and he tells him he wants to buy a very cheap car. Driving in an awful car, Bert is told it's $325. He offers $250 if he gets to use the car lot's workshop to knock up a trailer and do some repairs on the car. Bert drives back, but keeps getting on the wrong side of the road. The salesman's very upset, but Bert just laughs at all of this.
Yeah, in the next scene, we see Bert and Fernando, the salesman, still wearing a suit. They're doing some welding, and we find out it's 3 a.m. And Fernando says, "When you said you wanted to use a workshop, I didn't realize it meant all night. I'm going to have to go home, or my wife's going to kill me." Bert sleeps in his car, and he's woken by Fernando in the morning, who offers him some spare wheels if he can get another car going. After Bert's successful, Fernando's sort of like shaking his head and smiling, says, "I'll give you a job. I'll give you a job right now. Just work for me." But Bert says, no, I need to get on the road. So he goes back to the motel, and Tina offers to come with him to Long Beach to collect the bike from the docks. And Bert's still getting the grips of driving on the right-hand side of the road. Obviously, he's used to driving on the correct side of the road, on the left. The British side. And then at the depot, Bert is told his consignment suffered some damage during the crossing after some tons of fertilizer were loaded on top of the crate. When he opens up, Bert's relieved to find the bike is undamaged. So he goes back to the motel, drops off Tina, thanks her and says goodbye. She gives him her number, telling Bert, "Let me know how you get on." She kisses him, and Bert hits the road, towing the bike on his self-made trailer, complete with its streamlined fairing. So, bit of a reality check on that bit. The bit with the car, he pretty much did this every time. He'd buy a real cheap old car. They'd say, "Well, look, we've got this one, but this doesn't work, doesn't work." He'd say, "Well, can I use your workshop?" And he'd fix it. He bodged and, well, I say bodged, he fixed all sorts of things. He had such a creative way of, you don't have to have the real part. You can get one of those parts, melt it down, make this, do that. As we said earlier, the thing of people going the extra mile to help him because he just charmed them, it happened time and time again. And the consignment being damaged, that did happen on one of his trips.
Yeah, and it was fertilizer. Yeah,
fertilizer loaded on top. And actually, the bike did have a fair amount of damage. And he ran that year, and I don't think he did very well. And he basically had to give up and go back to New Zealand and do some rebuilding.
Yeah. I mean, I think in reality, the first time he went over with a bike, the ship was late and he had to drive all the way up to Seattle and Washington to its first port of call to pick the car up. So there were various difficulties that they sort of, which, and various events that he had to overcome. And while none of this is particularly accurate, I don't think, but it does set the scene, as you say, for him working on old clunkers, putting his hand to almost anything, charming his way around with various types of people. So, yeah, while not literally accurate, it does set the scene for what sort of a character he was, I think.
Yeah, and that I think it's one of these things where all the things we see happen to him, but just not on one trip.
Yeah.
So they conflated it into the one expedition, and the feeling we get is this is the first time he went, and in reality, the first time Bert went to Bonneville, he didn't even have a bike. He just went as a spectator. Okay, back to the movie.
Okay, no problem. So back to the movie. Further up the road, we see Bert losing a wheel on his homemade trailer. The bike and trailer crash, we see Bert surveying the damage. He's in the middle of nowhere, but just gets on with his repairs on the side of the road, trying to fix the trailer. A yellow truck appears, driven by Jake Saginaw Grant, a Native American. Bert asks him if he's an Indian and says that this here could be the world's fastest Indian, referring to his Indian Scout motorcycle. With Jake's help and an improvised log as a slider instead of a second wheel on the trailer, they make it to Jake's caravan home. They're sitting by the fire that night, and Jake asks Bert why he wants to ride on that contraption. Bert replies that the joy is in the doing. The next day, Bert thanks Jake and says he's going to hit the road. Jake then gives Bert a necklace for good luck, and Bert gives him an old piston that he can use as an ashtray, even though Bert doesn't approve of smoking. Jake then gives some ground-dried dog's testicles for the prostate thing, he says, but warns him that they taste disgusting.
Yeah, back on the road, Bert's log is still being the second wheel as he was unable to fix the trailer at Jake's place. Then he pulls into a farmhouse yard and he meets Ada, played by Diane Ladd, who's a famous actress from the 60s and 70s. She offers a stub axle off an old Ford, and she's clearly a kindred spirit. Like, oh, you know, you can get the stub axle off the old Ford, I've got some welding gear you can use. So you see them working together, and then after the work's finished and the trailer's fixed, Ada takes Bert in a truck and shows him her husband's grave. And she says, oh, he died 12 years before, and I miss him. Bert shares his philosophy on life, that a man is born, grows, ripens, then fades away as if he'd never been there. And they're chatting away when a rattlesnake arrives and has a bit of a strike at Bert. But they escape the snake, and Ada asks Bert where he's sleeping that night. The next scene, Bert's waking up next to Ada in her bed. King's hit the road, and Bert prepares to leave, but Ada says, pop in on your way back, as I could use another little cuddle. So again, we see Bert's propensity for the ladies.
Yeah. In the movie, we next go to a roadside bar where Bert's asked by some locals where he's from. From Invercargill in New Zealand, he says. As he's chatting to the locals, Bert gets his chest pains again. He's struggling to stay upright, and as he takes one of the pills given by his New Zealand doctor, one of the locals advises Bert to visit the hospital, and we see Bert, he's asleep in his car by the side of the road, when a county sheriff pulls up and two cops approach. He's told by them that he can't just pull over the side of the road, and he's sent on his way by the police. At a roadside garage with a fixed trailer, Bert now is approached by a young American Air Force man in uniform who asks for a lift towards Salt Lake City in Utah. They chat in the car, and Bert learns that the young man's on leave from Vietnam. Rusty, the airman played by Patrick John Pfluger, tells Bert that he'd like to come with him to see the salt flats for the first time. And then finally they arrive at Bonneville Speedway near the town of Wendover. Directed by Rusty, they arrive at the Salt Flats.
Yeah, he's quite overawed, and Bert tells Rusty about some of the records that have been set at Bonneville, Malcolm Campbell, Mickey Johnston, Ronnie Freeman and others. Rusty takes his leave and tells Bert he'll be watching for him in the record books, and Bert just tells him to take care in Vietnam. He sleeps in his car again out in the flats, and waking the next morning, Bert struggles to urinate with this prostate problem that he's mentioned a few times. And he takes some of Jake's dog testicles. He discovers they do indeed taste disgusting, but they do work. Then another car arrives, and Bert meets Jim Moffat, who's an American with a fancy-looking bike in this, like, a spaceship-like fairing. They chat for a bit, sort of. You can see Jim Moffat thinking, okay, this is a guy who's taking it seriously. But they go to check in, and Bert discovers he hadn't registered, and registration closed a month earlier. Bert's a bit distraught, protesting, how was I to know that? I've come from New Zealand. Look, I've come halfway around the world to ride my bike. So Jim Moffat tries to persuade the clerks, he's obviously known to them, tries to persuade the clerks to at least allow Bert to go through tech inspection. When he goes to tech inspection, or scrutineering as it's called in the racing world, the inspectors throw problem after problem at him, saying, well, your tyres aren't proper tyres. They're not speed tyres. He went, well, they are. I've cut the tread off with a knife. There's a brandy bottle cork that's substituting for an oil tank stopper. There's a hinge from the kitchen door at one place. The suspension is leaf springs. He's got no safety parachute, which they're meant to have. And Bert just sort of bats all these problems away, saying, well, it's my life. You know, they say he's got no fire extinguisher. He's got no parachute. His bike's too old, and so is he. And it really isn't looking good for him to be allowed to run.
Now, we've already said that his first trip to Bonneville, he was just trying to, you know, as a spectator without in reality. So I imagine that he would have known that he needs to pre-register in reality, and that this is just a fiction.
This is a let's just put a little hurdle in his way, because he did overcome lots and lots of hurdles, but he doesn't mention in any of his interviews about his trips that he was told, oh no, you should have pre-registered or anything like that.
Yeah. And he did cut various corners, I know, which they're suggesting that, you know, he does in this scene, but he didn't face quite the confrontation that they show in the movie, I don't think.
No. But he definitely, when he went to tech inspection, he attracted a lot of attention, but mainly because of the age of the bike, and to a degree, the age of Bert himself.
I mean, by now the bike's over 40 years old, isn't it?
Yeah, it's 1926, I think, or 1920 Indian Scout, which originally had a top speed of 54 miles an hour. So he's definitely taken it on some.
Okay.
So, back to the movie.
Yeah, so we're back with his bike. Bert's approached by a large American chap who introduces himself as Rolly Free, played by William Lucking. Rolly finds out that Bert sleeps in his car and so invites him up to their place on the Western Ridge. Bert is now established in a motel with his new friend Rolly, where people are getting to know him. Also at the motel, Jim Moffat is still arguing with the registration clerks, saying that the bike may not be the most modern, but the rider is, quote, the real deal. Told that the bike doesn't even come close to passing the technical inspection, Jim tells them that they're looking like a bunch of chicken shits. Then we see Bert in his room polishing his tyres with boot polish. Jim comes to see him and asks what he's doing. Bert says that the polish fills in the cracks in his tyres and makes them look spick and span. Jim, however, has got bad news. He says sorry, but they will not let him run. Bert, clearly very upset, begs Jim to try one more time and to see if he can influence the officials. Bert says all he wants to do is go over 200 miles per hour once, and then he'll sod off back to New Zealand. Jim sees Bert experiencing some more chest pain, and he looks concerned, but Bert once again just fobs it off as indigestion. Jim says, I'll try again, and then the next day we see Speed Week going in full pelt with various cars and bikes flying on their speed runs. Rolly Free and a bunch of men are seen by the clerks wheeling Bert's Indian towards the starting line. The officials are alarmed and they're stopped from interfering by two ladies in the start box. The men protest that Bert could kill himself. The ladies respond, so it's his life. The clerks do try and stop Bert, who says he's just giving her a warm-up. The two clerks start, have a chat, one of them saying that they really ought to give him a go. Compromising, the officials say that they'll follow Bert the next morning in a vehicle to check that his bike handles properly.
Again, as we mentioned earlier on the reality check, there was never a problem with him not pre-registering. He did have to answer several questions about his bike because it had technology that some of these guys would have never seen except in museums. But the handling check thing, that was routine. The impression I've got is they'll do that with every bike before it's allowed to do a speed run. So they just, they'll just drive behind it and just say, just, we just want to see that it goes straight and you can handle it and you can stop and all this sort of thing.
The boot polish on the tyres is a nice little, little aside, and I don't know whether that really happened or not, but I know that he did cut the tread off his tyres to, for speed reasons, and cut too close to, you know, to cut too deeply. And he was told in one of his trips that this patch of tyre won't pass because you've cut too far. And so, or he just made sure that whenever they inspected the tyres, that that piece of the tyre was touching the ground and it couldn't inspect
the bottom.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, after he did that, in reality, the AMA, the American Motorcycle Association, who administered Speed Week at Bonneville, or certainly did then, they started to say, no, you can use, because it was very difficult to get slicks for, you know, as in treadless race tyres, for some of these older bikes. And they said, no, okay, that's fine. People can cut tread from their, from normal road racing tyres, and that's allowed. And that was thanks to Bert Munro persuading them and demonstrating to them that it actually worked if you knew what you were doing. So back to the movie. The next day, Bert's told to roll nice and gently as the vehicles follow to check it handles properly. You've got about three cars for him. There's the registration clerks, there's Jim Moffat and Rollie Free and Marty Dickerson, both of whom were real characters, and they themselves were amongst the fastest Americans at the speed flats back in the 50s. So they're following him, and they clock him at 75 miles an hour, 85, 95. Then he takes off and leaves the cars in his wake. And when he comes back, oh, sorry, when, as they watch him disappear, the clerk who'd argued, oh, come on, let's let him go, he says, well, I guess that answers the question if he can handle it. Eventually, Bert turns the bike and heads back to the start. Arriving back with him, the clerks tell him that he's allowed to make an official time run. And it's really quite it's a lovely scene. As Bert's shaking their hands and he says, you will never know how much this means to me. And you can see this really is the culmination of his sort of life work. Rollie Free congratulates him, but Bert confides him and says, I've got a big problem. Because every time I get to 110 miles an hour, the bike starts to wobble. But he thinks he's got a solution. He says he needs about 20 car batteries and a painter's blowtorch. So we next see Rollie and Marty Dickerson, played by Walton Goggins. They souvenir, as Bert describes it, a load of batteries from a scrapyard, in other words, steal them, and borrow a blowtorch. And he melts the lead from the batteries to make a metal brick, which Bert says, I'm going to place it in the nose of the bike to improve the balance. At dinner with Rollie, Marty and Jim Moffat, he explains the effect his planned change will make, moving the central pressure behind the center of gravity and thereby improving stability. And they say, well, how are you going to test it? He said, well, I'm going to go drive across the state line from Utah to Nevada, because there's no speed limit there, and I'll test the bike to see how it is after the change. Which sort of gives you an idea about his ability to improvise.
Yeah, and there was something in reality, wasn't there, about a battery? He wanted some lead from a battery in one of his runs for stability. I don't think it was 20, though.
In reality, no, he did make a lead brick, and I'm sure I read this again last night. I'm sure it was 60 pounds, but he didn't place it on the front of the bike. He placed it in the front of the rear wheel to improve stability.
Yeah, and it worked, didn't it? In reality, that approach had the desired effect, didn't it?
No.
Ah, okay. Just like in the movie.
And this is something, actually, I think this is really good that the movie gets this right. So going back to the movie, we see Bert screaming along a classic single-lane American countryside dead straight road, just disappears over the horizon, absolutely howling along. But going the other way, a cop sees him, gives chase, sirens and lights and everything. Bert pulls over and the cop approaches him. He says, do you know how fast you were going? And Bert, with disarming honesty, says, oh, about 150, 160 miles an hour. The cop laughs and says, yeah, that sounds about right. At this stage, Marty and Rollie arrive in their truck, chuckling to each other, saying, see him get out of this one. The cop says, is the bike registered? And Bert says, it is in New Zealand. And the cop's sort of like, he's quite calm. He says, look, I know we've got no speed limit, but we really don't want people killing themselves. Bert replies, yep, that's fair enough. So he lets him go. The cop lets him go. They hook the bike up to the car, and he jumps in with Rolly and Marty, and they say, did it work? He said, no, the lead brick made it worse. He said, I'll just have to deal with the wobble when I get there. And he's also concerned about the heat coming off the exhaust cooking his leg. Rolly suggests wrapping his leg in asbestos cloth. Bert says, that's a good idea. Anyway, we get back at the flat, and the ladies we met earlier tell Bert they've got a surprise for him. They make him close his eyes, hand him a leather bag, and lead him somewhere. And then when he opens his eyes, he's surrounded by a crowd, and he's told that he's been unanimously voted Sportsman of the Year, because no one's travelled so far and tried so hard. And they say, because of your situation, we thought the best prize to give you is we pass the hat around to raise you some extra dollars. Bert, quite emotional, thanks them, saying the original top speed of his bike was 54 miles an hour, and he hopes to improve that a little, promising to try and justify their respecting him.
So that's a lovely scene, isn't it? And there's a lot of truth to it, isn't there?
Pretty much all of it. All of it. Again, this isn't the wobble he had was the year that the bike got damaged in crossing, and actually when he made this lead brick with this great idea, which should have worked in principle, actually made it worse, so he discarded it. So he wasn't ridiculously proud, just because he'd have an idea, I think this will solve it, he'd try it. Classic engineering.
And his newfound friends, in one of the trips, they actually did have a whip round for him, didn't they, and gave him the cash to help tide him over.
So and he was voted Sportsman of the Year by the Salt Flats attendees. All of that. And also the thing about the heat coming off the exhaust, he did try wrapping his leg in asbestos to try and limit the heat coming off. So, yeah, it's all pretty much spot on. The thing about the bike being registered, that also came up, and he'd say it was registered in New Zealand. And the New Zealand plate looked similar to a Californian plate, because on one of the trips he was driving up to from Los Angeles docks up to Bonneville, and he found out that he had to pay a state license. It'd be like $10 in every state, and he said, I can't afford that. And this cop says to him, or this official, he says, well, just try it, they may not stop you. And he gets away with it. He just gets away with so much because he's such a charming man. Anyway, back to the movie.
Next in the movie, we see Bert arriving at the starting line. He kisses the pendant given him by Jake, and we see Rolly and Marty wrap his leg in asbestos. He climbs aboard as his crew look nervous. He finds that he can't fit inside the fairing with the asbestos cloth. It's just too thick, and he can't fit into the cavity. He removes it and climbs in. They ask him about, you know, the potential to get severe burns on his legs, and he says, screw it, I've got a spare one. So he takes off for the speed runs, following a dark line drawn in the salt, which looks like a snowfield, it's so white. So while he's racing off across the field, we cut back to the announcers that are tracking his, the officials that are tracking his speed, and we hear 167 being announced as his mile 2 speed. Then we get the announcement for his mile 3 speed, which is 173 miles per hour. By mile 5, he's up to 183 miles per hour. Bert doing 3 miles a minute now. At mile 6, he hits 193 miles per hour, and the crowd are thrilled. We see the bike start to wobble, and Bert lifts his head to steady her with some drag, his goggles flying off into the slipstream as he ducks his head back inside the cockpit. As he passes mile 8, the announcer is shocked to see 201.851 miles per hour on the clock. Jim, Rolly, Marty, and Bert's new admirers cheer wildly as the announcer tells them that it's a new record. We then see Bert trying to control the bike. He falls, roaring in pain as the salt abrades his shoulder. He crawls out from the wreckage, groaning, and he sees a large burn on his leg from the exhaust. Nevertheless, he's laughing as he tells the sky, I did it. Then we see Bert's young friend Tom answer the phone back in New Zealand. And he's granted permission by his mother to accept a collect call charge. A call collect. A jubilant Bert tells him that he did it. It's the world's fastest Indian, he says. Arriving home, Bert sees that George, Tom's father, has mowed his lawn and tidied things up. Bert greets Tom as they open up his workshop and we hear Bert's voice saying, "It's nice to be home, back in my shed." As the script then tells us that Bert never stopped trying to make his Indian Scout go faster. He returned to Bonneville 9 times, they tell us, setting numerous speed records. Bert's 1967 record for streamline motorcycles under 1,000cc still stands to this day. And roll credits.
Yeah. It's funny, there's such a... Going to sort of reality on that, there was so much build-up to the climax, and I like the fact they just tie it up at the end with him arriving back home. And it's worth mentioning here, a lovely little touch in the film is... at the beginning of the film, Tom, his young friend, says, asks Bert, "Why do you pee on your lemon tree?" And he said, "Oh, it's the world's best fertilizer. Confucius told us that." And Tom says, "Who's Confucius?" He said, "Oh, he's an old fella, lives up the road at Dungannon or wherever it was." But this isn't actually true, because it's mentioned again at the end, because when he's going away, Bert says to Tom, "You can water my lemon tree if you want." And when he gets back, Tom says, "I've watered your lemon tree." He says, "Oh, it looks wonderful and healthy." This isn't actually true. Bert Munro didn't do this. Roger Donaldson, the movie's director, his father used to pee on a lemon tree. So this is Roger Donaldson's little homage to his father, which is, I think, a lovely touch. As we've said, Bert Munro went to Bonneville multiple times. This movie is, you know, he did fall at top speed on one run. He survived that. His bash hat, as he called it, his crash helmet, he breaks several of them. He knocked himself out and was concussed. I think he once, in one bit of the interview, he says, "Oh, I've been knocked out and concussed 8 times in my life." And he knows each of them, most of them involving motorcycles.
And as we've said, you know, they conflate an awful lot of events into one trip to Bonneville, but I think this scene probably conflates the most. It's just suggesting that he did all of this in one particular journey. But I don't, you know, his first trip, he didn't have a motorcycle, let alone set any world speed records. And they're suggesting that the 201.851 miles per hour is the record, and it's the one that stands to this day, and that's not quite true, is it? His world record, I think, is what, 186 for under 1,000cc? You'll know better than me, Marty.
Yeah, he was clocked at 205, but because what they do is you have two or three, I think it's 3 months now, and they take an average, which is how all speed records are normally set. What they do at Bonneville is you'd have to go in both directions. So if there was any wind, and there's a bit where Bert was just chatting to a German team who were there, and they said, "Oh, if the wind's over 1.5 miles an hour, we won't run, because it will slow you down so much in one direction or the other that there's no point." So now when they're looking at tenths of seconds, that probably is true. I mean, 1.5 miles per hour is virtually nothing. But there were times where he says he'd sit and they'd say, "Are you going out?" "No." "Are you going out?" "No." "Still too windy." And the wind would drop later in the afternoon, and then he'd go and do his runs. So he did get that. But this is the amazing thing. He got an Indian Scout that originally was, I think it was a 340cc engine. By now it's nearly 800cc. He's rebuilt it, reboarded it. He's added cylinders. He's done all sorts. It was designed to go at 54 miles an hour, and he got it over 200. But I don't think that was an official...
No, I don't think it was.
...knowledge record.
In reality, they suggest that he's sticking to that black line in the sand pretty carefully, but in reality, going at such high speeds and with so much, you know, stuff flying up around you, they often got disorientated and lost. And a couple of runs, I know that he was wasn't sure if he was still going on the right path, if he was on track, if he was being monitored. At one stage, he kept going to make sure that he was still in the right area, and he was actually 6 miles past where he should have been. So,
on another occasion, he pinned it on the outbound leg and thought, okay, that's good, turned round, but didn't get up to speed, because if your fastest on the outbound was mile 3, then on the way back, that same mile was where they take the average, so you had to try and be as fast as you could at that, and he got something wrong, he didn't get it up to speed, or it wasn't running correct, and he pumped some more oil in, And then, and so, although on one leg I think he did it 201, the average was 190 because coming back he was much slower. So yeah, there was obviously some technicality to it. And as you say, the sticking your head up into the slipstream just to stabilize the bike, he did do that on a yeah. number of occasions. And I don't think his goggles ever came off.
Yeah, I think they did. I seem to recall that they did at one stage, yeah. Well, anyway, that's it for the movie, and I think, is that it for our reality check as well? Have we covered everything we wanted to?
I think it probably is. I mean, there's so much that you could talk about Bert Munro. We could do a supplementary just on the rest of his life, you know, away from this, because it was such a character. There's a very, very nice interview with Anthony Hopkins, or Tony, as he likes to be called, with Jay Leno, American Trap Jay. You can find this on YouTube. And Jay Leno's a huge bike nut, and he knows a lot of the people that were portrayed in the film, like Rolly Freeman and Marty Dickinson and the like, and Roger Donaldson. And Anthony Hopkins knew Roger Donaldson. So it's quite a nice sort of connecting with him. Anthony Hopkins says, yep, he was definitely a character in that kind of way of, he might have been a bit awkward to live next door to, if you like to sleep. But anyone who's interested in finding out more about Bert Munro, in his own words, so you have to, you know, take some of what he says, maybe it's Bert's perspective on it. But Neil Birss, his book, that's Neil spelt with two L's, B-I-R-S-S. It's available on Kindle, that's where I read it. And what Neil does is, where Bert says something that Neil knows to be factually incorrect, in brackets, he'll say, I think what Bert means here is the 1931 Australian motorcycle race, or, you know, and he's interviewed other people about Bert, and he says, sometimes Bert's recollection is at variance with other people's, so that's understandable, you know. But yeah, Bert Munro kept going. In 1975, where he had his 76th birthday during that year, the AMA finally put a stop to his speed records and said, look, I'm sorry, but you are too old. The film could be twee. It could have been a bit treacly. Personally, I didn't think it was. It didn't really get overly schmaltzy at any stage.
No.
But that's just me.
No, I think it's a charming film, yeah, and it doesn't overplay its hand, I don't think. It gets the balance pretty well right. I'm surprised it wasn't more of a box office hit coming in, just as it did break even almost for the production costs. But
yeah, I think if they called it Offerings to the God of Speed, it would have got a wider audience, because I think people maybe thought it was, I don't know if you know of Eddie the Eagle.
Yeah,
the British ski jumper who was famous for being really bad, what was his name, Eric the Eel?
The swimmer from...
African swimmer.
Yeah.
You know, the thing was, Bert Munro wasn't really bad, but it was the underdog thing. But I think when you say world's fastest Indian, people might have thought it was about an Indian sprinter from the country, India.
And it's funny because Donaldson's own documentary on Munro is called Off Into the Speeds of God, the God of Speed.
And maybe that's why he thought, well, I can't use that for the feature film as well, or people will get confused. But it's a great story. And if anyone hasn't seen it, you don't have to be into bikes. You don't have to be into speed records or engineering. It's just a lovely human film.
So therefore, for entertainment, what do you give it? 8?
Oh, yeah. Comfortable 8.
Yeah, I agree. And history, what do you reckon? It's not too bad. I mean, it's a bit like Hidden Figures that we did a little while back, where they took 8 or 9 years' worth of events and put them into one summer in America, well, which we gave that a high score. I think, I think we'd give it at least a 7, wouldn't you agree?
I'm thinking seven. I mean, it's very Ron Howard in the sense that it tells lots of truths compressed, and the couple of vignettes which are maybe not actually specifically true are done to illustrate the truth of Bert's innocent charm that would just have people helping him, you know.
Yeah, agreed. All right, well, shall we wrap it up then? We've given the scores. The only thing we need to do is advise of the next time.
Yes, and probably one of the most requested films we've seen or we've had requested over the last few months is Dunkirk, which was out last July. So I think what we're going to do, or what we are going to do, is we're going to cover Dunkirk. I would just like to apologise to Caspar Heilman, or Hillerman, for not acknowledging his email, which came in a few days ago. So this really should have gone into the intro, so I'll probably drop this in at the beginning, maybe, with a bit of clever editing. But Caspar said, "Gentlemen, job well done. I just finished listening to your two-part special on Spartacus, and it helped pass 2 hours of a dreary day stocking vegetables and fruit at work. May I suggest the movie Enemy at the Gates? If you choose this film, you can find..." Yes, there's some fine source materials to consider. Stalingrad by Anthony Beaver, or if you're truly ambitious, Colonel David Glantz has written a Stalingrad trilogy. Respectfully, Caspar D. Heinemann. Caspar, thank you so much for the email. We've looked at Enemy at the Gates, and that may feature in a Ones That Got Away, because the main character played by Jude Law is completely fictitious. For anyone who's not aware, it's about a Russian sniper during the Second World War, Battle of Stalingrad, and Ed Harris plays his German counterpart and have a duel. It's pretty much like Saving Private Ryan, whilst based in a wider historical framework that's correct. Pretty much none of the detail is. Now, people could level that at Dunkirk, but because the focus, it's not like they go off and do something different to what actually happened, like they do in Saving Private Ryan and to a degree in Enemy of the Gates.
Yeah.
So we are actually going to, we're going to have a look at Dunkirk and we'll see how it stands up.
Indeed. I think that's it for now. So thanks for your time and I hope to see you soon, Martin.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Andrew, and I'll see you next week.
Hello, Motopodders. This is Jim, and this is a little segment I'm calling Jim's Corner, where we're going to talk in-depth about technical things and MotoGP, whether it's tires, riding technique, or today's topic, mass dampers. Not too long ago, Crash.net posted a picture of what's inside of Ducati's salad box. Now, what was shown in the picture was a bunch of electronics and Dorna camera equipment. And as most people believe, that is being used as a mass damper. So what exactly is a mass damper and how does it work on this Ducati? Well, it's a bit of a story and I'm going to try to explain it to you. So hopefully you will understand it and impress your friends. Basically in life, everything has what's called a natural frequency. Everything vibrates. Any piece of steel you may pick up, it has some frequency and it vibrates at that frequency. Basically, it's like a tuning fork. We've all seen a tuning fork. You tap it, it vibrates, it gives off a sound that we can audibly hear, and you can use it to tune pianos or anything else. What's happening is that you are exciting the natural frequency of the material and amplifying it into sound that we can all hear. So we may have experienced this idea inside of like a car stereo. You may be driving along, jamming to your favorite music, and the door has a rattle in it because of the speaker that's in the door has now excited the metal of the door and is causing it to vibrate at a frequency that you hear, which you don't want. So maybe you take the door apart and it's simply tightening up some screws, or maybe you took a piece of duct tape with a bunch of washers to change the weight of the door so that it would not rattle and your stereo would sound really good. Not that I've ever done that to any of my car stereos, but I'm just saying you could do it if you needed to. One of the worst examples in engineering history of the bad effect that is created from natural frequency problems is the Tacoma Narrows Bridge. Now, those of you who may not know about this, this is a bridge that was in Washington State, sort of the west coast of the United States. They built a suspension bridge which looks very similar to the Golden Gate Bridge, and it was used to span across this narrow. Now, the problem was that there were some strong winds that would blow against the bridge, and the bridge would start to sway in the breeze. No big deal. The cables are there designed to flex and give a little bit, but the winds would reach a speed at a certain point. They would excite the bridge tremendously, and the wave of the bridge moving back and forth would get bigger and bigger, and eventually it was nicknamed, I think, the Wandering Bridge, and it would sway back and forth and continually, and finally the winds were so strong one day that it added on and added on to the natural frequency of the bridge to the point where the bridge actually tore itself apart and fell down. Now, engineers don't really like that, so what we do is we try to reduce that, and we use a mass dampener, and that mass is simply added to a structure to try to change where the natural frequency is. Think of it this way. Big, tall buildings, like the big towers that are in Dubai, or maybe the Petronas Towers in Kuala Lumpur, or the Taipei building, or maybe Willis Tower in Chicago, as you go up into the atmosphere, winds become incredibly strong. They push on the side of the building, and if they're strong enough, they can actually sort of bend the building a little bit. Now, the engineers account for this, and the structure is able to take it, and it can move, and it can go back and forth. But if that motion becomes too great, people sense that motion, and they become fearful. They think that maybe the building may fall down, when really it won't. So what we need to do is we need to dampen out that particular vibration that people are fearing. So what they do is at like the top of many of these very large buildings, they put a huge pendulum up there, sort of like a pendulum that you would find in like an old cuckoo clock that sways back and forth. So as the building were to move to the left, the pendulum would swing to the right and counteract that motion, and it dampens that effect. So that's sort of what a mass dampener is, and sort of some ideas of where it is used in this. So now it's like, well, why in the world does this even matter to a motorcycle? Well, that's a complex problem that we're going to talk about here. Basically, when motorcycle racing started in the 50s and into the first part of the 60s, riders sat very much in the saddle. They simply turned the bikes, and the tires were like bicycle tires. They were very narrow, had very tall sidewalls on them. Well, as the tires were to become more and more grippy and the bikes developed more power, well, there wasn't any room in the tire anymore for the bike to vibrate or wiggle and take up vibrations of the road or other things that the suspension maybe was not dampening out. So what would happen was you would get a big wiggle where the front end would kind of wobble around in the handlebars of the riders, and you'd see them sort of going down the road wiggling. So the engineers decided that the way to get rid of that was, hey, the frame is actually flexing. It's moving where it shouldn't, and the frame needs to be stiffer. So engineers would take it, they would add some more steel to the frame, maybe use bigger diameter tubing, or put some gussets in some areas of the frame to strengthen it. This would create less flex, and with less flex, the rider felt more comfortable, he'd go faster, and he would then want a grippier tire. And all this would cause a circular motion that would go around and around until the rider had got back to the same point that he was experiencing this frame flex. So this really kind of took off and became even more relevant in the early part of the 1980s. That is when Michelin developed the radial tire. Now, the radial tire was very different from the old bias ply tires that were used, and suffice to say, it was a different way of creating grip that was to give better feel to the riders. That's a whole topic of bias ply versus radial tires that we could talk about in another segment, but let's just focus on the mass damper at part of this. With the radial tire, this allowed more grip, and with more grip, and specifically it added more edge grip, because now you could create a rounded profile on the tire, and that allowed riders to lean over farther. So by leaning over farther with more grip, we got back to more flex again. So the engineers had to go back to the steel frames and started adding more and more steel to it. Eventually, they got to the point where they were adding so much steel to the frames, the bikes were becoming extremely heavy. The Yamaha engineers at this time stepped outside of the box and created the first aluminum frame for racing, and it was known as the Delta Box. The two down tubes coming down the sides, the single shock suspension, Yamaha developed all of that stuff, and it is how we look at modern sport bikes today. In fact, we look at modern motocross bikes today with aluminum frames on it. All started with Yamaha, in the 80s. The reason they went with aluminum was aluminum weighs less than steel, but it's also more rigid than steel. So basically, they now could create, had a new way to build stiffer frames so they wouldn't flex, so that they could add more power, and then they could add more grip to the tires. And eventually what happened was we got back into that same cycle again, where we needed more power, so we put that in there. When we needed more grip, we got more grip, then we got more flex, and then the frame started flexing again. So then we had to take it and add more gussets and stuff to these aluminum frames. So all this sort of repeats itself and goes around. But at some point, Yamaha actually had developed a motorcycle frame that was so stiff that it brought in a new phenomena, and that was that of chatter. And this is because the profile of a radial tire on a motorcycle is very, very low. It's maybe a half of an inch, maybe 12, 14 millimeters tall. When that goes across the bump at a 45 degree lean angle, there's no give in that tire anymore. There's no give in the sidewall. With no give in that sidewall, now that give has to go somewhere. Since it's not in the tire, it had to go to the suspension. But the suspension couldn't take up that bump anymore because it's at a 45 degree angle. Suspension is made to work inside of the plane that it is. It's supposed to be working 90 degrees up and down. It's supposed to be perpendicular to the world, and that's how suspension works, because that's the action that it's moving in. The problem is, it tilted at 45 degrees, and now the suspension doesn't want to slide up and down anymore, and it doesn't want to flex either. So now we've created a really bad problem, where now the front end of the tire may vibrate or oscillate up and down very quickly, creating what's called chatter. And chatter is one of the scariest things that a motorcycle racer can probably have happened to them on a motorcycle. You literally feels like the front end of the bike is hopping all over the place, and because it is oscillating going up and down, and it really isn't hopping, but you have no feel in the front end whatsoever, and you can't go fast because you don't have this feel. So we have this problem, and now we got to figure out some way that we have to go back and actually fix this problem. And at this point, we're talking about being in the late part of the 80s. FEA and computers were starting to become powerful enough and reliable enough that engineers could use these tools to develop their chassis. So they started to basically build in flex, if you will, into the chassis again. Not a whole lot, but a little bit. But they were able to work into certain areas where they were able to make sure that the bike would flex and feel right for the rider. So as we went into the first part of the 90s, and that middle part into the late 90s, we were getting these different types of frames, and it was hit or miss whether the engineers had dialed it all in right with the engine characteristics of the motors and all of that. So the aluminum was having a bit of a trouble, and you kept on getting chatter, no chatter, and really no one could really kind of figure that part of it all out. So Ducati with their 916 went to a different direction. They went to the steel trellis frame. And the cool part was, it was using FEA to decide, here's where we need to actually put some material in to make it rigid so that it would actually work well and flex properly. And here's where we can take the weight away to get that flex. And here's how, also where we can take weight out so that we're as light as the aluminum chassis. Again, Ducati's 916 was a stunner. It looked great. It was fast. And it started to win World Superbike Championships. The other manufacturers, and the Japanese manufacturers in particular, didn't really go back to steel frames seeing the success of Ducati. They tried to develop their aluminum frames in there, but they never did quite get it right all the time. They would hit and maybe get it right, and it may work with this set of tires, but they weren't consistently fast. Think back to 2002 and the great World Superbike battle between Troy Bayliss and Colin Edwards. Colin Edwards' RC51 was complete and total junk until they hit Laguna Seca in July, when his team left one of the bolts that held the head of the rear cylinder to the frame. When they left that bolt out, that allowed the motor to flex and to flex the frame, and gave Colin Edwards the feel that he needed to be able to go fast on that motorcycle. He then ripped off, what was it, 6 or 8 victories in a row, culminating with that amazing run at Imola to win the 2002 world title over Troy Bayliss. Ducati at that time had their steel trellis frame, but they were getting back to the point where so much grip from the Michelin tires, they were starting to get back to this bad chatter case again, and were having to add steel back into the bike again. So that vicious circle had started happening to them again. So where does this lead to in all the Ducati MotoGP bikes? Well, basically, today's MotoGP bikes must be rigid. They must be able to work the suspension properly. They must be able to do that to work the tire properly, to get enough heat in the tire to create enough grip. But we also need to have that feel, and we need to be able to make a rider feel happy on that motorcycle. If he's not happy on it, he's not going to go fast on it. And this is where you can look at all the computer simulations and you can try to design something properly, but that intangible that is feel for a rider causes you to make and second guess yourself. Remember a few years ago at Qatar, the opening round of the year, Honda was trying to make their bike handle better, and they went to a frame that was not nearly as stiff, and Danny Pedrosa would head down the main straightaway and it would shake so violently that it would knock his feet off the foot pegs, which is not a good thing to go. And as Honda moved on, they added a little bit more material and stiffened the frame and kind of got back into a sweet spot that Danny and the other guys actually liked the Hondas to be at. So what does this mean for Ducati right now? Well, DG Antonio has taken over. Ducati had went from a trellis style frame to the carbon fiber frame that only Casey Stoner could actually ride. And then from there, they let Rossi onto the bike. Rossi then said, you got to get rid of this frame and you have to go to an aluminum frame so that we can get the feel that we're looking for. And that's where they are now. And they've been developing that aluminum frame since the Rossi era, which is maybe from 2013 onward. So Gigi Dallinia is trying to get his bikes to turn mid-corner, which is the essence of MotoGP today, is the mid-corner. Is the tires are so grippy, there's so much lean angle that everybody's using now, that the bike has to turn in the mid-corner. And that's where the Ducatis are lacking. They have plenty of straight line speed, they have plenty of acceleration. It's that mid-corner and being able to turn mid-corner. Well, to do that, you need to have a bike that'll actually sort of flex a little bit. Think of it this way. If you were to take a piece of paper, draw out your favorite, draw out a racetrack, and you put one 180-degree hairpin turn there. So take a paperclip, unfold it till it's straight, and race your paperclip around the track that you drew. When you come to that hairpin corner, it's very hard to make that straight paperclip go around that corner. But if you were to bend that paperclip ever so slightly, that paperclip would then be easier to get around that corner. Well, that's what Gigi Dallinia has done. He has said, okay, we're going to make the frame a little bit less flexible and allow it to move around a little bit. I'm sure there was a bunch of computer simulation that was done, and I'm sure Gigi had actually erred on the side of caution and didn't take as much out and get the bike as free as maybe they wanted to, or maybe as free as what Lorenzo needs. But I think they probably took some out of it. And what they did is they found out that the bike could wiggle in a straight line or kind of oscillate around on its centerline axis, which is not going to be good. Head shake at 180 miles an hour is not something that I would want to have. So Dallinia had to come up with a way to solve that problem. And so what he did is he creatively took all the electronics, the Dorna camera equipment, and put it in this box at the tail end of the motorcycle. Now, putting it in that tail end puts the weight on the back end a little bit, which is not really necessarily the best part, but it gives it a very long lever arm so that as the bike starts to wiggle, it has a hard time moving that mass at the tail end back and forth to wiggle with it. In essence, all that mass in the back end becomes a mass damper, and that damper dampens out that wobbling or wiggling effect, but allows that motorcycle to be a little bit easier to turn mid-corner. Still not as easy as a Honda, still not as easy as a Yamaha, but it's making it better. And that basically is what a mass dampener does for the Ducatis. It's used to sort of change the natural frequency of the frame so that as the bikes roll across rough ground and they develop chatter on the front end of the tire and the frame starts to flex, it keeps it from getting out of control, which keeps the riders happy, makes them feel good about the motorcycle, and allows them to push on and ride hard. And I think we've seen that it must work, because the Andrea Dovizioso put in some of the best rides I've seen on a Ducati since Casey Stoner back in 2007. So now I hope you know a little bit more about mass dampeners. I hope that helps you out. Maybe you can go impress your friends at the track and tell them that's what's in the back of the back of it, of the Ducati, in the salad box. And hopefully you liked it. And that is the end of this first episode. Talk to you guys next time. Bye.